Let's turn our attention now to the weather. Mostly sunny skies and unseasonably mild weather is expected today as high pressure remains in place across the region. Later today, a low pressure system will track northeast from the southern plains, and rain will spread from Missouri into western Illinois beginning this afternoon. The system will affect the area through tomorrow with occasional rain. High temperatures today will range from the upper 30s across northeastern Iowa to the low 60s across western Kentucky. Low temperatures tonight will range from the upper 20s across northeastern Iowa to the upper 40s across southern Missouri and western Kentucky. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, partly sunny, the high 53. The wind from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour tonight. Occasional rain with a low of 37. The wind will be out of the northeast from 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, occasional rain. It will be cooler. Look for a high of 42. The wind from the east at 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain tomorrow evening. We'll see a low of 35. The wind will be out of the northeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high of 42. The wind from the northeast around 10 miles per hour. Sunday night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s. Monday and Monday night, mostly clear with a high Monday in the mid 40s and a low Monday night in the upper 20s. And the outlook for Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high in the low 40s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the low 30s to the mid 50s. It was 32 degrees at Rockford, where fog was reported. At O'Hare Airport, 38 degrees, cloudy there. In Bloomington, 47 degrees and partly sunny. Mattoon, mostly sunny, 55 degrees. In Carbondale, cloudy and 52. At South Bend, cloudy and 39 degrees. It was 51 degrees and cloudy at Lafayette, 51 at Indianapolis, where it was partly sunny, and Terre Haute reported a mostly sunny sky and 53 degrees. Willard Airport at the top of the hour, 50 degrees, a partly sunny sky. The relative humidity, 68%. The dew point, 40. The wind out of the east at 10. The barometric pressure, 30.36 and falling. And at 12:40 Central Time, 51 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. When we recognize one another, when we read, when we drive our cars, we rely on our eyes. The macula is in the center of the retina at the back of the eye. It allows us our straight-ahead vision, our ability to see detail. When problems occur with the macula, the eye loses that ability. Writer Stephen J. Lyons is coping with macular degeneration in his left eye and the possibility that over time he might lose his vision in that eye altogether.
First, Dr. P. drips a dropper's worth of numbing medicine into my left eye. Then he instructs, "Look down and to the right." He comes at me from the left. I don't feel the needle enter my eye as it releases its load of lidocaine. This prep work is the easy part. There's still another more powerful shot to come. I have been diagnosed with ocular histoplasmosis syndrome, most likely caused by the airborne spores of the fungus Histoplasma capsulatum. Ocular histoplasmosis syndrome is the leading cause of vision loss in Americans ages 20 to 40. I am 55 years old, a late bloomer. The microscopic fungus can be found everywhere in our Illinois soil, in this area often called the Histo Belt, where the National Institutes of Health estimate that 90% of the adult population has been infected by histoplasmosis. The spores usually settle in our lungs without any incident, but when they spread to the eyes, it affects the macula, that part of the retina that provides the detailed vision we depend on. The macula allows me the simple pleasure of seeing the lines around my wife's smile in the morning when I bring her coffee, the dozens of variations of red and purple in an autumn prairie sunset, the earliest yellow greens of spring, my daughter, my grandchildren, everything that I can no longer take for granted. The injection that Dr. P., a vitreal retinal surgeon, will administer today is supposed to decrease the abnormal growth of blood vessels under the retina that leak through the lesion. Without treatment, the leaking blood vessels can damage the macula and permanently destroy the healthy retina tissue. The medicine used in the injection is Avastin, a drug more often administered to colon cancer patients and, until recently, to breast cancer patients. "Lean back and look up," Dr. P. gently holds my eye open with his thumb and forefinger and liberally splashes iodine inside. "The iodine burns. Normal," he says. "All normal." Then he lifts my hair away from my forehead, from the infected eye. He does this with the lightest of touches, the tender gesture that a parent might give to a child. I was not expecting this, not in this cold, sterile room surrounded by colored posters that show all the horrible ways our eyes can fail us. For the rest of the day, I can still feel his hand removing the strands of my hair. I love his hands, the steady hands of a surgeon. I love his confidence. I love his knowledge. Most of all, I love that he is trying to save my eyesight. "We can do something about this," he said when I first came to him in despair. I began this journey believing that one day I would wake up and my vision would be normal again. I now know that will never happen. For the last 2 months leading up to this occasion, I began my day by testing my left eye, by staring at a white window shade. A large floater appeared. Some days it resembled a turtle or a translucent jellyfish. Some days I'm trying to see the world through a solid lump of coal. Straight lines bend and waver, faces distort as if reflecting from a funhouse mirror. If I had to run my life looking at the world from my left eye, I could not do it. No driving, no writing, no reading. If I lose my eyesight, how will I remember what I've seen? As I approach the midpoint of my fifth decade, each new medical issue begins with disbelief. How can there be blood in my urine? How can my heart be beating at twice its rate? No way my PSA number has doubled in the last year. The denials and rationalizations usually take place with my primary care physician in the little room. You know the little room. It's the place with the dog-eared golf magazines where we sit waiting, always waiting, half exposed with the short gown that ties in the back like a straitjacket. It is in the little room where my doctor can sense if I am in full avoidance mode and where he will push me toward the referral to the specialist and the beginning of a myriad of uncomfortable tests that confirm that, yes, I am aging. At my age, you would think I would know that eventually the spinning bottle of medical fate would stop in front of me. I've known too many people who have passed from this earth because of cancer and bad hearts and even worse, just plain bad luck. The why me I might have asked in my 20s has now evolved to why not me? Let me share some information. I am 6'1", 175 pounds. For a respectable body mass index of 23, I work out 6 days a week lifting weights and heaving on an elliptical machine. I eat organic spinach daily along with a handful of raw nuts and several helpings of fresh fruit and veggies. I do not watch cable news or go to professional cage fighting matches. I am not a drinker or a doper. And even though I worry, I fret, and I mull a lot, in general, I have, up till about a year ago, felt sort of invincible. So when my left eye began to distort straight lines, I reflexively scrambled for a logical explanation. I was staring at my laptop in a hotel room in La Crosse, Wisconsin, near the Mississippi River. It was at the end of a long day of reporting for an airline magazine, and I was looking forward to a celebratory dinner. Suddenly, yes, it was that precise, suddenly a wave began to move across the top of the computer screen. It would not stop waving. I tried to reason that the problem was an ocular migraine or eye strain. Maybe the computer was about to crash. In the morning, I knew all would be well. But by the next day, as I flew home over the unglaciated hills and valleys of southwestern Wisconsin, I knew that this was a condition I could not rationalize away. Back in the eye doctor's office, my pupils are now fully dilated. Two pale green full moons afloat in an off-white sky. On Dr. P's computer screen, the cross-sections of my retinas resemble geological maps like the topography of mountains I once hiked across as a much younger and more confident man. "See the lesion," he says. "It's directly above your field of vision." Dr. P then pins my eyelid open with a speculum. Flinching is no longer an option. "Look down and to the right. You will feel a little pressure." Define a little pressure, I think. A nurse slips into the room so silently it's as if she's floated through the walls. She sits down next to me and takes my hand. Her hand is warm and soft. Mine is cold and sweaty. She squeezes. I squeeze back. Dr. P comes in from the left again, but no matter how quick and stealthy he is, I know that a powerful shot of medicine is about to enter my eye. Medicine my body has never experienced. Medicine that might or might not save my sight. Dr. P administers the shot as if all of this is normal, like buttoning a shirt or tying a shoe, but there's nothing normal about having a needle inserted directly into your eyeball. I feel nothing except my racing heartbeat. When he is finished, he pats my shoulder. "I hope you weren't planning to go back to work today," he says. "Keep your left eye closed for 24 hours. I don't want you to do anything. Just take a nap or listen to music. My next shot is in 6 weeks." He leaves the room. The nurse releases my hand. I begin to breathe again.
Writer Stephen J. Lyons, he says people experiencing any distortion in their vision should seek treatment immediately. Lyons is a 2-time recipient of an Illinois Arts Council Fellowship for prose writing and a Pushcart Prize nominee. He is the author of 3 books, most recently The 1,000-Year Flood, Destruction, Loss, Rescue, and Redemption Along the Mississippi River.
When David Finch was 30, his wife Kristen gave him a quiz to screen for Asperger's syndrome, a condition on the autism spectrum, and the results were striking.
It was this unbelievable moment of self-recognition.
My first thought was, of course.
How they used an Asperger's diagnosis to repair their marriage. Later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Thursday, WILL and its community partners team up again to fight hunger. This year, for every pledge made to WILL, Common Ground Food Co-op will donate the cost of 8 meals to Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Your pledge supports the programs you depend on and fights hunger in our community.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 3rd of February, 2012. It's the birthday of the novelist James A. Michener, born in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, 1907, author of Tales of the South Pacific and many other books, who said, "I'm not a very good writer, but I'm an excellent rewriter." It's the birthday of Gertrude Stein, born in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, 1874. She was 30 years old when she moved to Paris, and she lived there for almost the rest of her life. She lived in a house with paintings by Cézanne, Picasso, Renoir, Gauguin, and others, which became known as a great salon. Writers and artists came. Ernest Hemingway once said of her, "Gertrude was always right." She once said, "America is my country, and Paris is my hometown." And it's the birthday of the novelist Paul Auster, born in Newark, New Jersey, 1947, who said, "Becoming a writer is not a career decision. You don't choose it so much as get chosen. And once you accept the fact that you're not fit for anything else, you have to be prepared to walk a long, hard road for the rest of your days." Paul Auster, author of the New York Trilogy and other novels. Here's a poem for today by George Bilgear entitled Grecian Temples. "Because I'm getting pretty gray at the temples, which negatively impacts my earning potential and does not necessarily attract vibrant young women with their perfumed bosoms to dally with me on the green hillside, I go out and buy some Grecian hair formula. And after the whole process, which involves rubber gloves, a tiny chemistry set, and perfect timing, I look great. I look very fresh and virile, full of earning potential. But when I take my 15-year-old beagle out for his evening walk, the contrast is unfortunate. Next to me, he doesn't look all that great, with his graying snout, his sort of faded, worn-out dog look. It makes me feel old, walking around with a dog like that. It's not something a potential employer, much less a vibrant young woman with a perfumed bosom, would necessarily go for. So I go out and get some more Grecian hair formula, light brown, my beagle's original color. And after all the rigmarole, he looks terrific. I mean, he's not going to win any friskiness contests, not at 15, but there's a definite visual improvement. The two of us walk virilely around the block. The next day, a striking young woman at the bookstore happens to ask me about my parents, who are, in fact, long dead due to the effects of age. They were very old, which causes death. But having dead old parents does not go with my virile, intensely fresh new look. So I say to the woman, "My parents are fine. They love their active lifestyle in San Diego, you know, windsurfing, high alive, a still vibrant sex life. And while this does not necessarily cause her to come dally with me on the green hillside, I can tell it doesn't exactly hurt my chances. I can see her imagining dinner with my sparkly, young-seeming mom and dad at some beachside restaurant where we would announce our engagement. "Your son has great earning potential," she'd say to Dad, who would take a gander at her perfumed bosom and give me a wink like he used to do back when he was alive and vibrant. Grecian Temples, a poem by George Bilgear from The White Museum, published by Autumn House Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012,